For those of you that don't know, maybe you're joining the High Wire just recently. You don't know that I came from the medical talk show, The Doctors on CBS. I won an Emmy Award for producing the top medical show of its time on television. Well, what took me out of that was the discovery of a whistleblower named Dr. William Thompson at the CDC that came forward and said, we are committing scientific fraud, much like the studies we see coming out, you know, showing a danger in the DTP vaccine. The CDC saw a danger with the MMR vaccine and the fact that it could cause autism. And Dr. William Thompson provided 10,000 documents to back up the point that they covered up statistically significant information. If you haven't seen Vax, then you should go to VaxTheMovie.com and check that out. The reason I bring this up is that there is a new whistleblower that is now courageously stepping forward. Yes, someone that worked for the CDC. She's being referred to as the Utah whistleblower, just so we don't mix up these two incredible individuals. And a brilliant article just came out in Age of Autism discussing her findings and her truths and how she won in court, a true whistleblower. She was joined by editor and writer Mark Blaxall. So it is my pleasure right now to bring in Mark Blaxall, who's the author of Denial, and of course, a brand new face for us here on the High Wire, Judy Zimmerman. Judy, a lot of people, you know, throw around this term whistleblower, that anybody sort of that speaks out from an industry or something is a whistleblower. But in fact, I think you genuinely represent what a whistleblower is in that, correct me if I'm wrong, you were protected as your job. You were a CDC employee working in a university on autism research. You were starting to call out serious problems you had with how data was being used, and then you got whistleblower protection, but were fired anyway, and then you went on to fight that in court, and you actually won. What were the details of that very quickly? Because I think that, you know, first of all, I want to honor you and how brave you are to be stepping forward in, you know, in a world that vaccines and autism, and this is just such a really volatile conversation. But can you just give me a sense of, you know, what was that timeline and what actually happened there?
Yes. So I was a federal grantee and was working on a public surveillance grant to track the number of children with autism in Utah. And during that grant process, I came to believe that researchers at the University of Utah, where I worked, were illegally accessing children's identifiable confidential information. I went to a number of different individuals at the university. I went to the state police department. And it was shortly after that I was fired from my position and was taken off the federal grant.
And then you filed a lawsuit about that. How did, you know, what did the court determine?
So I did file a federal lawsuit. In the federal case, the jury determined that the University of Utah retaliated against me for reporting waste, fraud, and or abuse. And that was awarded under the Utah whistleblower statute. And we still have a court case pending in state court.
Okay, so that gives me a sense of who you are. Now, the two of you, Mark and Judy, you teamed up in a brilliant article on the Age of Autism website. The title is CDC's Utah Whistleblower and Autism Author Speak Out on the Autism Epidemic. Now, of course, Mark, we've had you on several times discussing the autism epidemic. Denial, I think it's probably the clearest book laying out how they're trying to avoid calling this an epidemic. All of the arguments they make that autism's always been here, you go back historically in Denial and really crush that perspective. I've always said I think it's one of the weakest arguments they have, and it's the one they're relying on more and more. So in meeting up with Judy, you know, and in this article, what was it that really grabbed your attention that you said, I got to get this story out to people. This is really important. How is this story taken to another level through the understanding of what Judy Zimmerman brings to us?
Well, there are many layers to Judy's story, and I've known Judy for a number of years now and have developed that high regard that you expressed about her, because she has been courageous and strong in standing up to the power of big research. But the gist of why I think maybe Judy reached out to me originally and why I am so fascinated by this story is that Judy was in the on the firing line, in the trenches, on trying to track the numbers about autism. And she ran up against a CDC bureaucracy that wasn't really interested in what was going on with autism, or actually they were interested in certain interpretations of the data. And the fact that the numbers kept going up was always an inconvenience. And Utah was one of those places where the numbers were really high and they were going up. And Judy, because of that, had the logical interpretation of what that meant, which was she began being interested in environmental causes. She even did some preliminary research on that. And I think she got crossways with the autism establishment, certainly with her bosses at the University of Utah. Yeah. And then I think there was also a phenomenon where they were starting to code the data wrong. And Judy raised the alarm about that. She said, we're actually missing cases of autism in Utah because we have data errors and we're not correcting those data errors. And that was another part of her whistleblower role. Part of it was privacy, but part of it was the data quality. And if you look at the numbers that started coming out from the University of Utah, they were high and rising, and they were up there with New Jersey, which has some of the highest and consistently rising numbers of autism in the country. But then all of a sudden, mysteriously, they started plummeting. And it was likely because of these data errors that Judy was highlighting. But then around the time she began highlighting those, that was when they fired her. So I think Judy has been standing up for accurate data, for raising the alarm about autism rates. And I think it demonstrates that when you start doing that, it's not necessarily a good move for your career. And Judy found out that out the hard way.
Judy, you know, Mark said something interesting there, that you started saying, if this is continuing to go up, you began looking at potential environmental cause factors, and that somehow that might have gotten you sideways with the people you were working with. And obviously you're tied in with the CDC. Can you explain to me? Because I think when we watch the news and we hear Sanjay Gupta will say, we are looking at every part of this. There's extensive research going on for the cause of autism. We just don't know what's doing it yet.
We don't know what causes autism. I mean, that's fair to say. We're not sure as a scientific community what causes autism.
It seems to me that even someone walking down the street would say, you know, certainly there must be environmental factors. I know that there's been a lot of research on your genetics and your DNA, but describe for me the climate in academia, with the CDC. Why is it a problem to start looking at the potential that environmental factors are affecting the rate of autism?
The university where I was working was a highly emphasized genetics. And the chairman of my department of psychiatry, William McMahon, his interest was in discovering the gene for autism. And so when the registry, the surveillance program, kept seeing increases in the number of children, that didn't fit the narrative that genes alone couldn't be accounting for the drastic increases we were seeing in numbers. So, for example, in the mid-1980s in Utah, the rate of autism was 3 per 10,000. And fast forward to 2006 and 2008, the rate was 1 in 47. So that didn't fit the narrative that it was a gene or genetics or combination of genes. It had to be something environmental. And they were very invested in maintaining research dollars to do gene research. So they were not interested at all in me pursuing any environmental research.
And Judy, now, correct me if I remember this wrong, yeah. but I think you did an abstract of, you know, and you published an abstract and got written up in the newspaper about possible environmental contributions to autism. And if I'm not mistaken, you got written up for doing that.
Yes. So I had received funding through the National Children's Health Study to do a study looking at environmental air pollution contaminants in relationship to where the mothers lived when they were pregnant. And we found some significant findings that if a mother lived within a certain distance from a toxic release inventory site, she had a much greater risk of having a child with autism. And after the media started covering that story, the chairman, McMahon, wrote me up saying my research lacked credibility.
Mark, when I hear that, you know, obviously the focus of your work has been looking at vaccines, which I think fits in the category of an environmental factor. But isn't that exactly, wouldn't that have been the scapegoat the CDC was looking for? Oh, it's pollution. Pollution is the problem. Why would they have had an issue with that in your mind?
Well, first of all, I've focused on a lot of things, including mercury, which is a form of pollution. And so, and that I think was part of the mix in Utah, which has some heavy issues of mercury exposure based on wind patterns and so forth. So environmental factors of all kinds are relevant. But you know, I think there's an orthodoxy that Judy faced, and this guy, Bill McMahon, they were convinced they were going to find the genes or the set of genes or the thousands of genes or the genetic fingerprint of autism, and that would explain everything. And the fact that these numbers were going up, that, as Judy said, that just destroys the narrative. And so you know, any acknowledgement of an environmental issue gets to some kind of biological mechanism. And the biological mechanism doesn't need to, and almost certainly is not restricted to a single type of toxin. And so whether it's, you know, air pollution or diesel exhaust or mercury and, you know, because of mining activity or mercury in a vaccine, ultimately, if you acknowledge environmental causes, you're going to get into the issue of what's happening in the infant or fetal brain that is causing the development to go haywire. And I don't think you need to have a single cause. In fact, you almost certainly won't have a single environmental cause that will produce the dysfunctions of autism. What you're likely to have is bad things happening to fast-growing brains causes them to grow in inappropriate ways or to get inflamed. And that can come from a vaccine, it can come from the ingredients in a vaccine, or it can come from toxins in the environment. So I think Judy's point was right on. As soon as you say the increases are real, you kind of knock out the great autism gene hunt. And that was mm-hmm. the war. And so anybody that just opens that little box, even if it's in a very respectable, non-controversial way that it's air pollution, you're going up against the Holy Grail, which is the gene hunt. The other thing that Judy, you know, it's worth mentioning is Judy's boss, the guy that wrote her up, you know, had a patent on diagnosing autism through the genetic fingerprint. So the stakes were high, and you can't even ask that simple question that Judy asked. You can get a grant maybe, but if, you know, if people start getting interested in it, your boss is going to come and bring the hammer down.
It's not how people think science is working, right? We think science has this massive objectivity that it knows it's going to cast out a wide net and send scientists in every direction to find the answer. And yet, the more I've looked into it, and Mark, you've really tipped me off to a lot of this, you start realizing that it's just there's a tunnel vision on what they want to prove, and they won't even look in any other space. You know, right as you were writing this article, an incredible headline came out of Ireland, in the Telegraph in Ireland, saying that their autism rate is something like 1 in 34, I believe it said. One of the highest rates, really, in the world. And what I found shocking about the article is all it talked about was how we've got to start rearranging our schools and being able to handle this massive increase, and not a single question, why? Why is autism reached 1 in 34 in Ireland? And then your story comes out right at that exact same time, Judy. And I want to go over the numbers because, you know, New Jersey's really close to that, right? I mean, we've been looking at New Jersey. I think they're at 1 in 36 or 1 in 34. My understanding is they have the sort of the most robust and accurate monitoring system. But Utah was right in line with New Jersey. And then suddenly we start seeing, in my mind, it was one of the first times where the reporting was, hey, it looks like we're not on a constant increase. It's going down in Utah. But what was going on behind the scenes? Because you were there while we were watching this drop in autism in Utah, were you not?
Yes. So right about the time I reported privacy concerns, we were doing some routine data cleaning, and we had discovered some errors, which we were correcting. So we discovered that 200 children with autism need to still be reviewed and included as potential cases. At that time, I was prohibited by the University of Utah and my boss and my entire grant team from correcting those errors. Had we been able to correct and add those 200 children that likely would have come in with as autism cases, the rate in Utah would have continued to mirror New Jersey's. So in my mind, the University of Utah, with the complicity of the CDC, intentionally left out 200 children, deviated from their study methodology, and didn't disclose that they had done that.
That's an incredible statement, really. And I want to, you know, we have a new audience that has started watching us because of COVID-19, and all of this data tracking is becoming something that we're much more aware of. But I want to point out, as we talk, when we call, you know, coronavirus a pandemic or an epidemic, there is this insidious, terrible issue going on with autism. And not to speak, I mean, obviously we get in this space where I'm not saying anything against people that are suffering from autism. Mark, you have a daughter that is now an adult that, you know, is on the spectrum. So you know very well, you know, the subtleties with which we have to sort of address this issue. But it keeps rising, and it is reaching a point now at 1 in 34 or 1 in 36, or even these numbers that you're quoting in your article, somewhere around 1 in 58. And we went from, what, 1 in 58 to 1 in 54 by your estimates? What are we, you know, even in their conservative estimates, where are they admitting we're at right now?
Well, there are different data sources, and they measure subtly different things, so we get different numbers out there. The one surveillance project that Judy was a part of is called ADDM, A-D-D-M, the Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network. And what they've done, and there's some real logic for what they're tracking, at least in concept, is that they're looking at eight-year-olds. They always, every 2 years, every other year, they do a survey and they measure the rate of autism in eight-year-old children. The reason to do that is that it often takes a while for a young child to be diagnosed and get through the system. The average age of diagnosis of the more severe forms of autism is around four. And so if you go too early, if you collect the data too early, you'll miss some kids. And so right. The intention of the eight-year-old timing is to get a constant age cohort, so you're not mixing up the timing of diagnosis with anything else, and you're giving autism time to be fully diagnosed. And that's what the 1 in 167, 1 in 68, 1 in 58, 1 in 54, those numbers are numbers that come out of the CDC every other year. And that's what the system that Judy was a part of, the network Judy was a part of. There's another survey that the CDC does, which has a different method, and they look at all children from ages 3 to 17. They're part of national surveys that go out every year, the National Health Information Survey, the National Health and Childhood Survey. And what those get is less precision about the birth year and the age cohort, but they also get more older kids. So you get those kids from 8 to 17, and more often than not, the milder forms of autism, like what we used to call Asperger syndrome, will get picked up later. The average age of diagnosis of Asperger's was 8. And so any study that stops at an 8-year-old birth cohort is going to miss that tail. And these other surveys pick up a big chunk of that tail. And those are numbers. 1 in 36 was an that was a number that I pushed out there. 1 in 35, you've got the most recent survey form that was in the article. And those are numbers that are pushing 3%. Wow. And so that's a slightly different definition. It's 3 to 17-year-olds. It's not a crisp birth year. It's got more full ascertainment, more years for a child to get a diagnosis. So it's not as though those numbers are different. They're just different methods. And I think the 1 in 36 number or the 1 in 35 number is going to pick up more of the higher functioning cases, mm-hmm. whereas the ADAM network picks up mostly, full syndrome autism and what they call PDD-NOS. So there are more severe cases that get picked up in Judy's network.
Judy, in this article, it points out that there was a growth of 9%, that it increased 9%. I believe it was over a 2-year period from the last sort of check-in on the data of autism, 9% in just a few years. But correct me if I'm wrong, because we're waiting to 8 years old, we're really looking back in the past right now. As a scientist, Judy, have you speculated or thought where we might actually be if we were looking at 2020 birth years? Do you think this is going to continue to grow in 8 years from now, in 2028, when we're looking at the numbers? Are you concerned at where we may find ourselves, or do you see this plateauing somehow?
I'm concerned about several things. First of all, the data CDC just released are children that were born 12 years ago. So we actually have no idea what the rate is, say, in 4-year-olds now or 8-year-olds now. The methodology they're using is very labor intensive, and it's not very time sensitive. So I think the U.S. has really missed the boat. Some countries like South Korea did direct testing, and years ago, those showed higher rates than the U.S. is reporting now. So I don't see any reason or any indication that the rates are plateauing at all.
Wow. And so, Mark, I mean, my understanding is that autism is more prevalent in boys than in girls. So when we're looking at these 1 in 59 or 1 in 35, that's both boys and girls together. Is there any, estimations at what the rate of autism is in boys right now based on this data in America?
In the latest study, the rate of autism in boys in New Jersey was 1 in 20.
Whoa.
And that was an 8-year-old born in 2006. And across the sample of 11 states that they had in the sample, the rate in boys was 1 in 34. So that 1 in 54 number includes boys and girls. Not to diminish girls, it's over 1% of girls in New Jersey. But, 1 in 20, that's, 5% of boys. I always feel emotional about that because I was born in New Jersey, and I looked around and there weren't any kids with autism that I knew in my town. There was one, in the whole town that we'd heard of. Now we're talking about 1 in 20. It's nuts.
It's incredible. Judy, those numbers to me sound like we have an epidemic on our hands. We have an epidemic that not only is tragic for those that are involved in it, but when I start thinking about the cost of what it takes to raise a child with autism, we hear it can cost millions of dollars to go through that process in a lifetime. And I start thinking about, the issues of how is insurance going to pay for this? How are we going to handle this? How are we going to continue to mount military? And where are the places this is going to affect? Can you explain to me why the CDC refuses to call this an epidemic?
My only guess, and it's just a guess, is that once they admit it's an epidemic, then they have to do something about it. They have to look at other factors in terms of causality, which they've been totally unwilling to do. And in fact, there's been a number of ways that the CDC systematically tries to lower the rates that are less obvious. So for example, how they fund and defund sites. So in 2006, the CDC defunded all the sites with the highest, the sites with the top rates. So there, once you defund those sites, you take those sites out, it lowers the rates for the next year or the next study year. So they really don't want to be forthright about what's happening to our children, because then they'd have to admit some environmental causality.
It's amazing, Mark, because obviously you and I met because I was involved with the film Vax, which it's touched on the whistleblower inside the CDC, Dr. William Thompson. And he describes how the CDC goes out of its way to start kicking kids off the study, manipulating the data in order to sort of get rid of this autism effect. What Judy just described seems like a far bigger issue. We're not just talking about a study now. We are talking about a systematic review nationally, looking at surveillance sites that are supposed to be giving us information. And she's telling us now that they are looking at the sites that are numbers are higher than others, and they're manipulating the numbers by defunding the sites that are showing higher rates. I mean, as obviously a well-educated, you know, university graduate that has been dealing with numbers your whole life, is this anything short of criminal? What is happening here, and why, you know, how are they getting away with it?
Boy, you know, I have been yelling, and I don't yell, I don't like to yell. I have been trying to raise the alarm about just the issues that Judy has described in the CDC's management of both the data and the message, and she's right on target. You know, Utah and New Jersey were up there high, and then they got defunded. I think New Jersey put up a stink and came back in, but in Utah they just fired Judy. Ultimately, because the issues came up in Utah, Utah got defunded too. But they put in low prevalence states. There's a whole set of very complicated things. And when you get into statistics, it's often that's where people's eyes glaze over. They don't want to understand samples and, you know, screening methods and the portfolio of sites and all of these things. Journalists who never took a math course in their life or passed a math course in their life are the last people to actually say, oh, I think you actually made an error in your calculation or your study design. It's where the curiosity stops. If it bleeds, it leads. There are all sorts of things that make sexy, you know, television, but the details of study designs aren't.
No, I disagree. I'm going to disagree with you, Mark, because, I mean, let me just disagree with that for a second, because I come from media, and this autism thing scares every single parent there is. It's terrifying. And just as I believe when I got involved with the William Thompson story, this would be the biggest story there is. If it bleeds, it reads. There is no bigger blood, you know, issue than the idea that when I think of 1 in 20 as a potential, I have a son. When I think about that as the risk factor, and I think about the CDC is putting out 20 cupcakes, as some people would put it, and one of these cupcakes is going to deliver autism in some way, whatever the cause may be, and I find out that they're hiding the facts behind that one cupcake that is 1 in 20. I mean, that, to me, any news reporter on MSNBC, on CNN, New York Times, that paper is jumping off the shelves. But you and I both know that no one is telling that story, not because it's not fascinating to the world, but because pharma is deeply invested in funding media and the sources that would be giving us the truth. I mean, do you see it any other way?
I concede the point. I think you're right. I wonder sometimes why the world just can't look at the logic. It's very simple, and it's not as simple as you'd like it to be. The Bill Thompson story in Vaxxed was a lot more straightforward. And you have Bill on camera or you know, on tape saying, you know, I feel badly about what I did, and I feel bad. So it's an emotional argument. This is similarly emotional, but it's a little trickier. They can hide behind numbers and whether a site's in or out, or what, you know, what trend is in what, you know, what part of the network. But yes, of course it's lying. It's lying with numbers. I wrote one article, you know, there's lies, damned lies. It's the old Mark Twain quote, you know, there's lies, damned lies, and CDC autism statistics. You know,
right.
You know, I just added a little bit. They're lying with data, and they're doing it. I don't know why they're doing it. I wish I knew. I think no one in CDC gets promoted by declaring autism a national public health concern. You know, anybody who tries to say that, you know, and or opens the door to that gets punished, because there is an orthodox view that it's all the genes. And if you don't sign up for that and just say, oh, well, we must be doing a better job finding the cases. No, they're not. This is the same method year after year after year. They do it the same way, and the numbers just keep going up. It's not because they're doing a better job. It's because there are more kids with autism.
Judy, I think the million-dollar question is this. This is the question I get asked all the time. Are doctors evil? Are scientists evil? Are reporters evil? When we talk about this manipulation of this story. And, you know, I want to ask you this question because it's so rare that we get, you know, it seems like every few years we get one whistleblower that will come forward and start sharing new evidence, and we see this assault upon their credibility. You were inside the system. Are you all alone in there, or are there a lot of good scientists that are seeing the same thing that you are, that are just afraid of the system? Or is the orthodoxy so strong that they just wear blinders into everything they do and they don't see it as lying? You know, can you give me a glimpse inside of, you know, the scientific world around autism? Why are so few people like you stepping out and showing us these anomalies?
I think it's about money. I think that if you need a livelihood and you want to keep your career, you cannot take on issues that are controlled by entities that are extremely powerful and well-funded. So as soon as you start looking at any environmental issue, whether it's vaccines and big pharma, whether it's air pollution and business that are contributing to that, whether it's products such as Roundup with glyphosate on it, in it, you are taking on powerful people. And I think the CDC has conflicts of interest with these industries, as do politicians. So I think it's extremely difficult for researchers to speak up, almost impossible. If you're pointing a finger at a business or an entity that has huge amounts of money.
I want to go ahead, Mark.
Yeah. I would add to that, Del. I think, you know, it's very difficult to be a practice. Scientists are terrific people. I know a lot of scientists and met some wonderful scientists in autism through the years. They're all trying to do good work. They are, many of them are deeply concerned about the issue. So I don't think we're, you know, it may seem like Judy's way out on a limb, but she's not. There are a lot of good people. There are honest and principled debates that go on. And I think the people that believe in genetic determinism, most of them, you know, really truly believe it. They have to believe a lot of crazy things
to make it work.
Peace with that. It would make it work in their own minds. But I do think they are honest and generally good people. I do think there are some bad people. And I do think the power dynamic that Judy describes is really important. No practicing scientist in America wants to run afoul of the National Institutes of Health. That's where all the money is. That's where the best money is. And if you step out of line with NIH doctrine, your career is not going places very well. And so they don't, because most practicing scientists aren't trying to change the world, aren't trying to, you know, solve world hunger or the autism epidemic problem. Most of them are just trying to make a living and go forward with the research that interests them. And there's a point where everybody knows and they get the message that if you step out of line, you know your career is kaput. And so that's, I think there are, you can criticize people for being afraid. You can criticize them for not being brave. Scientists are often not brave. And mm-hmm. and when you have powerful institutions that dole out the career benefits and the money that they have to go up against, that happens quite rarely.
Wow. I want to look at a couple of the statements and graphs that you had in this incredible article in Age of Autism. Again, that was titled CDC's Utah Whistleblower and Autism Author Speak Out on the Autism Epidemic. By the way, everyone, Age of Autism is a website, writes some of the best articles on these issues anywhere, so you should really stay on top of Age of Autism. This is just one of many brilliant articles that Mark has put out and other great writers. But I want to look at, you know, you sort of show in your article how CDC keeps changing the languaging. You know, look at this. In 2000, these findings indicate that ASDs are more common than were once believed and are conditions of urgent public health concern. And then in 2002, prevalence is a continuing urgent public health concern. And look at, in 2002, it says one child in every 150. So it's urgent with 150. And then the conclusion, they also confirm that ASDs are more common than previously thought and are conditions of urgent public health concern. Then we go to 2006. These results indicate an increased prevalence of identified ASDs among U.S. children age 8 years and underscore the need to regard ASDs as an urgent public health concern. 2018, look at this slight switch. ASDs continue to be an important public health concern in the United States. Then in 2010, ASDs are neither urgent nor important. 2012, ASDs neither urgent nor important. Then in 2014, only in the conclusion of this study, ASD is an urgent public health concern. And then in 2016, we're now at ASD continues to be a public health concern. Continues to be a public health concern. We're talking about being at one in either, you know, on the most conservative numbers, one in 54, potentially one in 35 if we're looking at New Jersey or the numbers we should have been seeing in Utah. You know, how do we get people to understand? I mean, is our mission now, Judy, to tell the world you can no longer trust government health agencies, government health professionals, when this is how they're languaging this? How, I mean, what are we supposed to learn from this?
Good question. If you'd have told me 10 years ago that the CDC would intentionally manipulate data, I would have said no way would they do that. I'd like to echo kind of what Mark said in that I believe there are many good researchers as part of the ADAM network. But at this point, the CDC seems to be controlling the narrative. So I'm not sure what the answer is until perhaps there's a change of administration at the CDC. I'm hopeful that Congress will look into some of the things I reported in terms of research fraud, privacy violations. But thus far, a lot of good people have spoken up, like you yourself, Del, who did a movie about corruption at the CDC. I'm not sure what it's going to take to change things. That was a powerful movie.
Thank you. You know, and what is powerful is seeing a graph that shows that once we have a great scientist working with the CDC in Utah, when they fire and move you out of that position, can we see this graph where you actually watch the autism rate go down just based on Judy Zimmerman being, look at this. We can look at the moment where, you know, what happened in Utah. Well, one of our best scientists that was being honest with the world was fired from her position. Oh, look at that. All of a sudden, autism's going down in Utah. It's just that easy. You come across as really sweet and beautiful, and you are when I meet you, but You have got a really incredible case on your hands right now. And just to touch on it briefly, there's so much. And by the way, just go read this article. I can't go through every brilliant graph and everything that's been laid out here. But this case is ongoing. And probably the more intricate part of this case is this privacy data and the fact that all of these, you know, independent companies wanted their hands and their paws on the data that you were protecting so that you were protecting these families, their identities and things like that. And my understanding is you now have the Attorney General in Utah moving in on this. And am I right in saying that you've even been having handwriting samples looked at by handwriting experts? Tell me just a little bit about why in this case does Judy Zimmerman have to have somebody's handwriting looked at?
So one of the first things I reported was that data, identifiable data, 750,000 children's health, mental health records, their most sensitive information was stolen. It was stolen. And in court, the university produces a document that they say, they claim, allowed them to steal those records. We couldn't get a copy of the original contract. We couldn't get any metadata regarding the contract. And so we hired a forensic handwriting expert to see, was that contract legitimate? Are the signatures real? Were they fabricated? Were they forged? And we believe that that one of the key signatures on that contract was forged.
And so as in, this is part of the case now, is this the state court case that you're talking about that you're bringing forward now?
So my state case is a breach of contract claim, and unfortunately, none of my cases deal with what I reported. So I so much appreciate you getting the word out about what I reported, because the what's of what I reported is not part of my case, and which is why I did it in the first place. So to this date, there's been no accountability.
Mark, you know, you've been at this far longer than I have. You would be famous for saying to me very early on, as I was still wet behind the ears, Del, you better get ready. This is a marathon. It is not a sprint. I think many of these discussions seem like they're coming to a head. COVID-19, I think, has done us a great favor in that many people are asking the questions that you've been trying to get them to ask, right? What is a vaccine? How is it tested for safety? How are we collecting data? All of these things, as much as they're trying to control us with it, they're actually bringing into our mind space questions about what is data collection? What is a blood test? I mean, everything. Do you feel like this marathon is beginning to accelerate towards some sort of end, or do you just think we're still a long ways away from getting anywhere with this issue?
You know, I'm not Nostradamus. I won't make projections. I do think the world is seeing what we have seen playing out on the front pages every day. And, you know, if people never knew who Tony Fauci was, now they see him every day and they see how somewhat arbitrary and capricious some of the decision making seems
or
to be.
Talentless, and, maybe. I've seen a scientist be more wrong more often, but that's a totally different.
Well, scientists are often, particularly if they're bureaucrats, Del. I mean, most scientists are humble people, and they will say the data says what the data says, and we have to follow the evidence. But what you have here are bureaucrats masquerading as scientists. And leadership is the issue. And very often, leaders of these institutions, yes, they will have degrees. Yes, they will have experience. But they make choices about their own organizations, about policy, and about their own careers that often have very little to do with the evidence. They are just going with the flow, or they're advancing the arguments that they know their institutions support. And so the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, NIAID, with where Fauci lives, they're all about hyping infectious disease. That's what they do. The CDC, they're a vaccine promotion bureau. So anything that says there might possibly be an environmental effect that could it plausibly include vaccines? That goes against the whole mission of the institution. So anybody who's rising up in those organizations is almost inevitably ethically compromised because they have to make those compromises in order to get promoted. The biggest person I hold accountable in this whole autism fiasco is Colleen Boyle. She's the one running the CDC's Autism Network, the National Center for Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities. That's where Adam is. That's where Judy's grant reported up through. And if there's, you know, her name through Vaxxed, and Bill Thompson reported to her. You know, she's running the show.
I mean, in fact,
she's
a lot of that team. I saw Marsha Lynn Jurgen Alsop is in here working with you, Judy, right? The same little cabal or whatever you want to call it.
The same little cabal of people. And there's the leadership problem. Those are the people that are getting rewarded, that are making the calls. They're the ones that are editing the abstract and the conclusion, whether or not urgent goes along with the word autism. And they're the ones that are saying, no, there's no epidemic, or maybe, or we don't know that there's an epidemic after years and years and years of vertical increases. So it's a leadership problem. And I think COVID is, you know, the coronavirus is bringing to the fore, these are the people that are making decisions to shut down our economy, to, you know, to do all the things that they've done. And it's that same small community of bureaucrats, you know, but they wear the white coats and they have the MDs and the, you know, and the fancy titles after their name, but they're, you know, they're not the be all and end all in this thing. And we need to recognize that it's legit to question them. And I hope that one of the things that will come out of this is that we will start, more people will start questioning the judgments and the integrity of some of these public health people.
Judy, I'm going to ask you a question I know you probably did not expect. But let's say we were able to get to Donald Trump and say we need a change in this situation, and we have a scientist with integrity that is winning lawsuits, that understands this issue of autism that you spoke about on your campaign. First of all, Judy, what position do you think someone like you could have to make a difference in this discussion? And if that position was open, would you take it?
That's a tough question. I am really dedicated to getting the word out about facts, showing with documents what my experience was, court documents, testimonies, depositions, facts on autism. I would love to share them with Donald Trump or anybody else who's willing to listen.
What position, when we look at this, you know, you mentioned Colleen Boyle. Is Colleen Boyle the tip of this issue? Can we get an insider's scoop on that?
It's coming from the top. As Mark said, all the messaging from the Adam reports, what other research, it goes through the top administrators, and the messaging's totally controlled by them.
All right. So, look, Judy, I want to thank you for being brave. Mark, I want to thank you for your continued diligence, brilliant writing, and working with Judy to get this story out the way you have. I know we're going to continue to follow it. It's just getting more exciting as we start looking into these handwriting issues. We're going to watch, I think, the Attorney General, hopefully in Utah, pick this up. You mentioned Bill Posey, a congressman, hopefully is going to start, you know, asking questions in Congress. We're not going to let this thing go away. I mean, from the beginning when I got involved with Vaxxed, you know, my career changed. But this is, I think this issue represents corruption around health of humanity in a way that not a single other story does. And though I keep being told, Dell, you got to drop autism, there's so many other problems with vaccines. There's all the autoimmune issues we can talk about. I still think autism is the greatest concern amongst parents, not only in America, but around the world, and they better be alarmed. They better be alarmed that one in 20 boys may be at risk for autism when this thing was unheard of 30 or 40 years ago, one in 10,000. This is an alarming rise. I think that, You know, if there's a message out there, any spokesperson, be it Sanjay Gupta or Rachel Maddow or whoever it is you follow that, you know, says that they're diligently looking at this, if they refuse to call this a pandemic, if our, you know, or an epidemic, I mean, or if our, you know, leaders are not looking at this illness, which really can alter a life permanently, so few have the ability to live on their own. And others that are so extreme they can't even speak or take care of themselves. I think that we will not let off the pressure. And Judy, welcome to this fight. I know you've been here before, we recognize you were here, but now having you on camera, going out to the world, get ready. This ride's going to get really interesting.
If you like that clip, then be sure to check out our live broadcast of The High Wire every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. Pacific time. You can watch it on Facebook, YouTube, iTunes, and Twitter. We'll see you there.